What did you say? There's less than a month before school starts? Oh man, I don't know if I'm going to be ready. I guess I should go on the podcast and talk with Jason about this scary subject of the start of a new school year. Get your education.
Backwards education. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon. Steve, let's talk about how to have a good first month of school.
Oh, well, I'm glad you made it a month. I was worried you're going to say the first day. That's going to be like, I'm 30 years into this thing and the first day is rarely all that great.
Right, right. No, I want the average to help us out a little bit. Right? Right. You get some good days in there. The second, third week kind of balances out that first day.
It is a rising progress for sure.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. No, I think that if you start well, the first day sort of maybe excluded, but if you start strong, you set the right tone, not sort of only with your students, but with yourself. I think there's reason to believe that you can continue on in that spirit for quite a long time, even perhaps through the whole school year.
Yeah, well, the beginning, as Dune starts out, the famous science fiction novel, the beginning is a very delicate time. It is key, right? Starting well is probably the single greatest determining factor of how you're going to end in the marathon of a teaching year, right? And I think all too often many teachers are looking for that grandiose moment when it's a series of maybe less than grandiose moments that build together to a good year rather than that one lesson that won the whole year for me. The first month is important for a number of reasons. I still think that there would be healing if and there probably is one out there, but you would be the one to know it rather than me. There's got to be a poem for the teacher. The poem for the teacher at the end of the first day, right? There's got to be something that you can read and know that the world feels with you. But I'm assuming you've got a poem. So let me at least put that out there.
I do. So this one is by Sister M. Therese, who I keep wanting to read her her poem, Testament. I've mentioned it before. But this poem is shorter than that. This poem is entitled Interrogative. It's pretty complex, I think, like all of her stuff that I have read. But I don't know if we'll linger long on it because, well, that's enough preamble. All right, here we go. Interrogative by Sister M. Therese. Who can give answer to your questioning? Why the swift bird should fall with splintered wing, or the young child lie broken beneath the sky? Why the first rose should know a blight? Why in the city of the heart there is a dreadful night? Plato sought answers where the shadows run in a cave pinioned by the sun. The Stagirite teased the tall gates of reason night by night, while Stoics, wrestling with inexorable fate, chide death for being late. Yet, to this mystery, you hold the key. A bare tree burgeoned on a hill, whose branches brush the sky, high as your Christ was high, who, lithe limbs stark to the wood, beneath a thorn-thatched hood, died and did not die, but lives unendingly in flesh of your humanity to raise new Calvaries over the sin-parched sod, whereon new Christs shall hang whose bright veins run with God. This is the simple answer even a child may understand and cup in its small hand, and yet a mystery still. Since pain took glory on, and sorrow bloomed on a hill. Okay.
That's
That was pretty heavy. I think
someone was saying earlier that was deep.
Yeah. Kind of a heavy. Maybe I picked the wrong poem for this conversation, because that's a pretty heavy one.
Well, the title caught me immediately, because I think that the single most powerful tool, especially at the start of a learning experience, is the question, is the interrogative. The more interrogative sentences and the fewer declarative sentences in the classroom on the part of the teacher. And I think in many cases on the part of the student, but certainly on the part of the teacher, is indicative to me of active minds and of student engagement, right? That I don't know how to start a lesson better than with a compelling question. I think so much of what we're talking about today is the establishment of a culture.
Good.
Right? If you have the pleasure that I have of teaching the same student over a series of years, at the present moment, my teaching assignments have me with sophomores and seniors. You know, so the freshman English teachers do a wonderful job of scaring the daylights out of freshmen. You know, when you have Mr. Elliott next year,
right.
So they come in with great fear and trepidation, and I do everything I can to continue. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, sure.
But so there is this introduction, right? That's what the first month of school is for many of us. I think we all too often associate it with review, because of the summer problem. Right.
Yeah.
I refer to it as the summer curse. So much of what you learned last year has fled out of your minds. So rightfully, the Spanish teacher, the Latin teacher, the English teacher, maybe less the English teacher, the mathematics teacher,
certainly the math teacher,
right, are reviewing like crazy to try and get them back up to where we left them off, you know, back in May or June. And so overcoming that problem is certainly a part of the first month. But looking forward, you're setting in play, here is who I am as a teacher. Here's the expectations I have of you as a student. And I think for the artful teacher, you know, who in the world are you all?
Right.
What have I been bestowed? What's this year going to hold for me as a teacher? I have to find that out by asking a lot of questions and giving, in my estimation, some students comment that, boy, we worked so hard at the beginning of the year. Now it seems easier. And really the grade book kind of reveals that, because I tend to give a lot more, seek a lot more data. That's a terrible term for it, but
no,
but
it's okay. It's okay. I'm
in trying to get to know them, I'm asking a lot of them.
Yeah.
Write me this essay, respond in your journal to this, show me your skills, basically. So I know where I'm at and what I need to cover the rest of the school year. And then we'll do the mathematics of how much that we're going to lose of that over the next time.
Sure. Well, so let me sort of interject here and say that I think what you've said so far sort of reveals a lot about your teaching style. What I mean by that is, for instance, if your class, if you taught in a lecture hall, right, where you just got up with your notes and read, essentially, then what particular humans ended up in those seats would be of either very little or no consequence, right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't really actually matter, because if your students are merely information receptacles, then that you're not going to change the way that you sort of do that. So it doesn't matter. But I agree with you that for a teacher at the beginning of the school year, if the kind of education that you do requires involvement from your students. If they are participants in the education process in any meaningful way, then yeah, it's going to start. It has to start with a lot of getting to know your students, but not merely in the sort of, hey, let's kind of be buddies so that you believe me more and I can shove more information down your throat, right? Instead, it's, I need to know where you are. I need to know your own proclivities and your idiosyncrasies, because we're going somewhere together and we've got to get there together. So I'm going to be relying on you just as you're relying on me. And we're all going to be sort of working toward it.
Yep. Yep. And so as I mentioned earlier, and it deserves some development, if the student is going to be doing anything in the class, then I have to know what they're capable of, what skills they've already acquired, and thus implied what skills I should be helping them develop as the year progresses, according to what would be common for a sophomore or a senior in high school to have. I'm not trying to turn them their sophomore year into graduate level students, but right. I am trying to convert them from being sophomoric into junior. And I know I'm using politically incorrect terms, but I'm trying to progress them a year further in their education, not just with, as you're saying, the information, but with, and even there, just for a moment with the lecture hall example, it still would behoove me to know what they already know so that I don't waste my time telling them things they already know, if lecture is my goal.
Right.
I mean, that's much easier attained than the kind of familiarity you and I are discussing, which is reflective of the kind of classroom that we have. If I'm gonna focus on, for instance, an interrogative classroom, right? If you want to use the term Socratic classroom, then they ought to know something. You know, even in her poem, right? She brings up the great Socratic student Plato, and his whole cave, and et cetera. Part of what I'm trying to do at the first month of school is get to know my students to understand what they can receive from me and teach them how to ask good questions. That's such an important skill in my classroom. What to do, because I'm focused mostly in my teaching at the present moment on literature. How well can they read?
It's important.
This will come back up when I know we have an episode planned down the road on the movie Man Without a Face. One of the moments in that movie is the digging of a hole and then the filling back in of said hole.
Oh, yeah. I remember that now.
But if we're going to, quote unquote, dig a hole, there's at least three things that need to be prepared for at the beginning of the class if the class is about digging a hole. One would be, you know, that introductory lesson, this is a shovel.
Right.
You hold it this way. It's effectively used in this manner. Don't dig with the handle, dig with the blade, and so on. And it sounds facetious until you get into a classroom and you start talking about reading or writing or some math function, right? And you realize that they're trying to dig with the handle or read in a manner that is very unproductive of any benefit to them. So there is the skill. Then I think a lot of the first month is motivation. Some of that's through the relationship. As they get to know you and you get to know them, there's this desire to please each other, right? And I know that to some that it's an anathema statement to say the teacher should be trying to please the student, but you are. You're trying to meet them where they're at and take them somewhere they don't even know they want to go, and they're not going to want to go there if they don't perceive that you know where they are. That's your point earlier.
Yeah.
If we're going to go somewhere together, I got to know where you're at on the map so that I can somehow get us headed in the same direction to this new location, the end of the school year. So with the digging of the hole, here's a shovel and here's where I want the hole, but why do I want a hole here? That's That's part of the movie example. He doesn't know why he's it appears to him he's digging a hole just to fill it back up again. And that's a very frustrating thing. And I find many students come into a school year without much sense of why they're there. My parents have made me come here. I'm trying to get a diploma. I want to get a good job somewhere way down the line for a sophomore. And so there's a great deal of, especially in an English class. I already know English, Mr. Elliott.
Yeah.
I know English good, Mr. Elliott. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, sure,
I had a senior write me a card one time and thank me for teaching him to write good.
Nice.
He meant the joke, but okay. I appreciated the art.
That's like, funny.
4 years for nothing. Thank you.
Right. All right. No, that's pretty funny. And it is sort of, they're not wrong, right? Like, there have been so many essays written on 1984. Like, why do I need to write this 3-page essay on 1984 if there's already a whole bunch of student essays on 1984? That's a good question. Thank you for asking, right?
It immediately brings up the notion of the liberal arts, right? Why are we using these? We're doing this to be free. You can certainly go out and copy one of those other great essays on 1984 and say, this is my thoughts.
Yeah.
If you
it would be faster.
You know, faster, more efficient, in some regards, probably get you a better grade.
Sure.
but I don't want you to be thinking other people's thoughts. I want you to have thought about this work and its impact, its meaning in the world that you live in, which is your – yes, you share the world with many other people, but there's also a very specific heart, mind, and soul that's being affected by the ins and outs of this story. And to say, well, I just agree with someone else is – I know it's very triggering terms, but I don't know how – that's slavery, right? That's somebody else is telling me what to do. If you're truly a free person, you've entered that story. You've gone, I agree with this. I disagree with this. I think that's true. I've been impacted by this story enough to want to change how I live my life. And here's how. And now I have something that's completely unique. Your 3-page essay that's got you in it rather than something from writemyessayforme.com.
Right. Well, yeah, that's right. And I think that so when I have a student who comes to me with this sort of thing, right, and they say, well, you know, I just sort of think what this person says. I don't need to write my own essay or whatever. I usually take one of two tacks. And the first is I say, OK, so like when you pray, do you only pray prayers that were written down by other people? Is that the only kind of prayer you ever pray? And they, being good Protestants, say, of course, well, being evangelicals, right? They say, of course not. Their sort of unique contribution or their own voice, they value very highly. And I say, okay, well, sweet, then just do that with this too, right? Like, let's, I'm not saying no one has ever said anything good. It to keep the analogy going. Yeah, read the prayer that has been written by somebody else. We could do with more of that. At the same time, you know, make your own contribution. The other tack that I will sometimes take is to ask a person, you know, okay, they say, I don't want to write this. I understand that. I've certainly been in the position of not wanting to write something before. But often, especially when I have students who haven't done that writing before, like I've never written a 5-page paper. Okay, that's cool. My question is, do you know what it does to a person when they write a 5-page paper? And they say, no, I assume it does nothing to a person, but no, I don't know what it does. And so I say, well, you might just see, because it's more than nothing, right? it does something to you to write that intently and that focused for that long. So give it a shot. And I've had students who are responding pretty well to that, but I think we're a little off in the weeds because we both like to talk about writing.
Well, no. So I was going to pull it back around by saying that this is exactly what we're trying to establish in the first month. The skills necessary, sort of the atmosphere, the culture. In my classroom, this is how we behave, and this is why we behave this way, and this is what my subject is about. If I have a minor in biology, so I've taught science classes. Mm-hmm. There's the same questions of really of motivation, of trying to get the student to understand why we're even here doing this. And the first month isn't the only place for that. I think there's remembrance of that throughout the year, a reminder mm-hmm. of it. But I think that the motivation up front is pretty key that you do need this and that I need you to be in it, not just going through the motions. Mm-hmm. That this is going to be a whole much better experience for all of us if we're motivated to do it, if it's worth doing. So I think that. And with that, of course, is the preparation necessary. There's quite a bit of learning how to turn something in or mm-hmm. I put it this way often. What kind of questions get Mr. Elliott going and what kind of questions turn him off? You know, there's a getting to know each other's art form.
Yeah.
That makes the whole journey then the rest of the month either go much better. Or if it's not done well, then there's sort of this wandering around in a mist kind of feeling. I don't know what is this guy's deal, you know? So I think getting the deal up front on the table, the cards laid out, and then getting a feel for that. That's why one of my first comments about the first day of class, the reason the first day of class is so erratic mm-hmm. Is because I'm trying to set a pace for them that I hope they will gather is, well, what's the term we've used frequently on this show? That of leisure.
Mm-hmm.
That we're going to mm-hmm. focus on really important things, and that means we need time to focus on those, which means there's a lot of other stuff that's just not going to get done. And I want them to feel, I know many of my colleagues love the word rigor, and I invite them to look at the background of that term because it's mostly negative. Good learning will at times be hard, and that's typically what we mean by rigorous. But I don't think it should be rigorous due mostly to quantity. I'm just doing. I can't keep up with the pace. I'm running too fast. I think it should be hard because of the depth, right? The interrogative is not a long poem.
Yeah.
But you can't just zoom through it. You're going to have to work at it. And that's exactly the kind of tone I'm trying to set early on.
Exactly. And that's so good. I mean, the the culture, you know, you tossed that word out early and I'm glad you did, because it's definitely something that you want to keep in mind as you're progressing sort of through the timeline, right? And so I kind of cut you off, but I have another question. I kind of want to switch gears. All right. So as I envision, you know, okay, it's the end of July. And so as I envision the time stretched out in front of us, there are several sort of discrete phases, right? And you're welcome to kind of quibble with these or modify them as we need to. But essentially, what we have is like the dusk of summer, right? Like those last weeks or that last week of minimal obligations. And then we have teacher development, teacher work days, right? The first day, then the rest of the first week, and then sort of the second week, and it goes out from there, right? So my question for you is, do you have any habits or rituals for any of those discrete phases? We've talked about some for the first day, sort of setting the tone by asking questions and whatnot. But leading up to that first day or after it, do you have particular things that you find yourself doing? Because like you said, is this year number 31 for you?
Yes, it is.
Wow. So you've been through this 30 times. How does it look?
Well, the phase that you left out that yeah. usually pops up early, right, somewhere around that teacher work days, is panic.
So that's your ritual, right?
It is. There is a.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't Me care too. Who you are.
Me too.
Best laid plans, right? Yeah. Of mice and men.
That's right.
There's that moment when you go, it might be the moment when you say, school starts tomorrow, or I only got a week left, right. Or it's already the first week of June. Oh, no. You know, there's just. There's never enough time. And so to me, a great deal, the summer in preparation for a good first month, to me, begins early on with retrospection, right? I try and end out a year well by thinking about it. What did I like? What didn't I like? I often, not every time, but often survey my students for their thoughts. Mm-hmm. I take it with a grain of salt. But the end of the year, they're often much more honest than all of their panic at the start of a school year, right? When they think it's going to be much worse than it actually is. And especially seminar, it's a great opportunity for me to hear them state, well, I was very scared about the class, but now and all the benefits they've got from it. So there's a retrospection that leads to prioritization, right?
Okay.
That's the panic indicates that you can't get it all done.
Yes, good.
Right. And so a lot of my summer is I've learned over the years to not try and redo everything. As the years have gone along, it hasn't all needed to be redone. Right. There's some stuff that actually worked that can be held on to and then trashed the next year, because while it worked great with a couple of classes, you know, times have changed, or students have changed, or it just bombed. This, so now I got to.
The Billy Joel references don't work anymore.
Yeah. Well, but there is a sense in which a lot of a teacher's life is recognizing what's timeless and what's attached to the times. Mm. And so for me, summer is properly a recharging of the batteries and an opportunity. There's more time on my hands, so I have more discretionary. Mm-hmm. Where do I want to go? What do I want to do? I'm a literature teacher, so of course there's some sort of literary goals that I have, typically far too many of them. But it's been a common, I would say about every other summer, I tackle some novel I've been wanting to read that was perhaps on the large side. This summer has been Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens. 800 pages. serial writers write forever. But 625 pages in or so here at the end of July, I'm hopeful that I'm going to finish it off before school starts and have that, that it could only be done during summer. But I recognize that all of that, as a literature teacher, I'm basically giving myself more material from what I don't teach Our Mutual Friend. I don't unfortunately teach in my current teaching assignments Dickens. He's outside my time periods, but I love him. Anything I read adds to who I am as a teacher, right? So
absolutely.
So, moving into the time we're in now, I'm taking a look. Okay, given everything I was trying to accomplish this summer, what's the most important and what can I finish off? And in particular, you know, some people put this off until the teacher work days or the last couple of days before school. About this time, lesson planning starts. My lesson planning is the big picture is the most important. what actually happens on a given day is very fluid.
Yeah.
Based upon what happens in that clip. But for me as a literature teacher, it's how many days roughly am I giving to each of these works so that I can get through my assigned, because the junior English teacher is dependent upon me having finished mine, right? And that'd be the same in science or in any of the contiguous subject, mathematics, or you know, got to get through Spanish 2 before they're ready for Spanish 3, so on. So there is a lot of thought being given to the pace and the scope and sequence and the year plan and all that kind of thing. That that part of what that's doing for me is giving me a calm heart.
And this is all in the basically the opening weeks of August?
Late July, early August. I'm getting my heart assured that I'm ready.
Okay.
Because there's a confidence that that gives a teacher when they come into that first day of class and that first month of class. Mm-hmm. I know where I'm going. Follow me. You'll be fine. I have to be very cognizant in this world of school management systems online and whatnot. You know, how much of the future am I going to reveal to my students at the beginning of the school year? In college, of course, they just give you the whole thing.
Right.
Here's the syllabus. Here's what all you have to do. Here's when it's due. And they never mention it again. High school students need a little bit more hand-holding than that. And they need the emotional. If you have the entire semester's or year's assignments laid out in front of them in this massive assignment list, you're probably close to killing them. they're looking at it going, no way. So,
well, because they're not just getting that. They're getting that times six or seven. Right.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And makes a big difference in that first month. If the student perceives you're on top of your game or they're just making this up the night before, that's a real difference in culture again in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you this. Do you you've been through this 30 times. Do you spend a lot of time in your classroom before the students are there? Messing with the chairs and the desks and the posters and the, you know, whatever decorations we'll call it, the furniture, like the physical space of the room. Do you think about that much?
I am somewhat of a Spartan when it comes to classroom stuff. Some of that's personality. I'm not very good at that. If I was asked to make an attractive classroom, to me, an attractive classroom is just as many bookshelves as full as possible. And one wall of my classroom is full of books, but, my classroom furniture changes with the hour during school. Depending on what the activity privileged to
you'll move the desks.
We have wheels on our desks. Yeah. And so they're very, even when I've had them in the four across five deep sort of lecture format, they're not going to look like that by the end of the class. Cause my students sort of move around. And if nothing else, when they get up out of the things, which is difficult to do, I've discovered, they go flying across the room, but so it doesn't behoove me much to mess with that kind of stuff. But I do spend a good deal to the consternation of some of my colleagues who are very busy frantically trying to put things up on the walls or arrange things. They often see me seated, staring out at the class. because to me, it is, you brought up prayer earlier there, the prayer is a pretty important aspect to me of the teaching art. I don't have a face that just screams, I love you.
I can verify this. Yes, it's true.
I'm from the Midwest where we kind of keep our emotions to ourselves. Thank you. And I'm sure that'll get us some comments, most controversial thing in the podcast. So my part of my work is knowing who I am and recognizing that a heart of love is built out of, in part, time with God, asking him for that and asking him to make, I'm never going to be the pushover, easiest teachers in the school type of person. That's just not who I am. Mm-hmm. But I want my students to know that I love them. And for that to happen, I have to love them. And for that to happen, I've got to pray for them and pray for myself and so on. And really believe that this isn't just boring English class, but this is the cultivation of wisdom and virtue that, mm-hmm. that each of these students is coming in needing. And I, of course, am a needy person as well, but I'm here to serve them as best I can. And so the heart has to be in the right place to do that. And so, yeah, that's certainly a focal point and a lot of self-criticism, right? What bombed and what am I going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And why did it bomb? Did it bomb because of that particular group of students or because it's just a bad idea in general?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a good sort of place to end the show. You know, what I have sort of learned from our conversation today is that panic is a natural part of the process, that it's not going anywhere, but that it's not arbitrary, right? That it's indicative of something, and that panic that you're feeling it is shows that you recognize that it's time to get down to brass tacks. And the way that you relieve that panic is through, as you said, prioritizing what needs to get done. And in particular, sort of praying through that transition so that it goes as smoothly as it can. You can't have your meat if you don't eat your vegetables.